Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Rituals undergird societies. Whether religious, civil, or secular, whether public or somewhat secret and hidden from view, ritual is present in all societies. What of the United States, a country with a past rooted in monarchy, which is very ritual-oriented? Well, the ways vestiges from the monarchical past in the United States shade American society is fascinating when attention is paid and rituals are analyzed and questioned. Why do some of the things people do in society that we carry from generation to generation feel so awkward, sometimes so painful? Why do ritualistic performances from the past continue to be done from generation to generation, even when they feel outdated? What about when they feel performative or unnatural? These observations of the awkwardness of sovereign rituals in the United States is the topic of this conversation with Dr. Dana Logan from the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Logan's book, Awkward Rituals: Sensations of Governance in Protestant America, tackles a conversation on the sovereign rituals between 1790 and 1850, the space between the American Revolution and the Civil War, when rituals like Freemason initiations, the work of evangelical societies and missionaries, promoted class-based societies while trumpeting egalitarianism. Logan talks about how a ritual becomes a box to check, a performance. This was a super cool conversation about awkward rituals out now from the University of Chicago Press. You can find Dr. Dana Logan on Twitter at popapologist, and I really hope you enjoy our conversation. Dr. Dana Logan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on the show and to learn all about your work and your book that has just come out. But just to kind of kick us off here, I'm wondering if you can spend a moment and introduce yourself to the audience, however you see fit.
Yeah, so my name is Dana Logan. I am a professor, an assistant professor at University of North Carolina in Greensboro in the Religious Studies Department. And I'm trained as a historian of American religion, but my PhD is in religious studies, and I consider myself to be someone in dialogue with other people interested in ritual studies. And anything else important about me? I got my BA at Reed and MPS at Harvard Divinity School.
Oh, wonderful. You probably know a lot of my past guests on this podcast. Harvard Divinity School has come up on several occasions here. You know, I'm curious about this academic origin, you know, your backstory about why you came to do the work that you do. And I love asking guests this. And I'm wondering if you can just tell me a little bit about some of your major stepping stones to finding these areas that you study professionally now. What were some of your major turning points along the way?
Yeah, so at Reed College, religious studies is a cult, which is like the best version of religious studies, where
interesting,
where you sort of like you know, have these rituals of induction, and you learn Durkheim and Weber, and like literally you make a golden calf and carry it with the professors. And I love that version of religious studies, and I try to be a missionary for it. But at Reed College, actually was in an art history class that I took a class on iconoclasm, and I was introduced to the idea of Protestant iconoclasm, so Protestant hatred of images. Mm. And it was in that context that I first found a book of Shaker vision drawings by Sally Promy, which is an incredible book. And that book basically introduces the very important concept that Protestants purport to hate images, but they actually love images. Mm-hmm. They have tons of images. And that sort of initiated this, I think, career-long interest in Protestants being failed Protestants. Mm. So I wrote an undergraduate thesis on Schuller's Drive-In Church in Southern California, which is designed by this incredible modernist architect, Richard Neutra. Sort of thinking about how mega churches are a particular kind of Protestant architecture. And then I went on to Harvard Divinity School, where David Hempton had just come there, and I was working with David Hall. And they were also all very into this idea of kind of Protestants failing at being Protestants. Mm-hmm. Or not failing. That's too strong. You know, Protestants having a luscious relationship to the material world. Despite saying that they didn't.
Sure, yeah. I feel like I have examples going on in my mind right now for what you may mean.
Totally. And then when I went on to Indiana, to the religious studies department there, my project came out of loving work like Webb Keene, who also is interested in Protestants kind of failing at dividing the world between subject and object, and Lee Schmidt's work on American rituals. And he's so many books that do this, but like, for example, his book on Christmas and Easter and Valentine's Day are all about Protestants getting very Catholic in a weird mm-hmm. way. And it was at Indiana that I kind of became weirdly obsessed with civil religion and this kind of old school Bella notion of civil religion. And my interpretation of civil religion is that what he was really showing is that this kind of Protestant nation weirdly needs all of these rituals in which it tells itself that it's disestablished, that there's no state church, but that it's also very moral. And that rituals were sort of central to that process. So I've been really driven by this kind of interest in first Protestant iconoclasm and now Protestant anti-ritualism.
Well, and I noticed that when you were describing your time at Reed, you also said rituals of induction. So this is something that I feel like is woven throughout all of your life, it feels like. Did you notice that you said that?
Oh, that's so funny. And you're totally right. So I am totally unchurched. I grew up in a commune outside of Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, wow.
It was started by my grandparents who were professors at UC Boulder and like very unethically started a commune with all their graduate students.
Amazing.
And it wasn't Christian at all. It was like in this very hippie new age context.
Sure.
And boy, did I do some embarrassing rituals as a youth. I mean, like I went on a vision quest with people who were not Native Americans. Mm. I did all kinds of rituals. And so, yeah, I think like religious studies and like Americans, I have at points in my life just loved rituals for ritual's sake. I guess that is a lifelong interest. Thanks for psychologizing me.
That was so fascinating. When you said that, I picked up on it right away, and I was really excited by that because I'm looking at your book cover right here, and it's like awkward rituals. I'm sitting right here. I was like, she just said rituals of induction about one of her college experiences. That cannot be a coincidence. Yeah. So I'm glad that I dug deeper on that. You know, and your career also overlaps a little bit with my hometown, St. Louis, Missouri. And I recently had Charlie McCrary on the podcast to talk about his work that he was, and we talked about his time at Danforth Center. And I'm wondering if you can just like tell me a little bit about your time there and you know what that was like for you.
Totally. Oh my God, it was such a thrill to be at the Danforth Center because as I was telling you, like Lee's work, Lee Lee Schmidt's work has been really formative for me. And Marie Griffith is like, she was my, you know, when I think about the luminaries of American religion, Laurie Maffley Kipp is there. These are like really big names in American religion. And just like Charlie said, when I listened to his interview, they have been doing this really important work of sort of taking what people think is important, which is American religion and politics. Like people think that's the category that matters. And then allowing all these scholars to do really interesting things within that. So to work on secularism, or in my case, to think about the ritual structure of civil society, which is not like necessarily what people think of as politics. Mm-hmm. So I think that they're doing immensely important work in terms of expanding the kind of work that gets funding.
That is absolutely wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. So let's talk about some of that work. You have a brand new book, Awkward Rituals, Sensations of Governance in Protestant America from Class 200 at the University of Chicago Press. And I want us to unpack this title a little bit first and foremost. So I want to take it in reverse order, ritual, then awkwardness. So I'm wondering if you can tell me about ritual in your view and within the context of the book. What is ritual?
Great. So I think at this point in religious studies, ritual is very much defined by, or it, the category is sort of owned by Catherine Bell. And I think what she's done is she's created a consensus that ritual is more than religious activity, that it doesn't necessarily just have to be in religion, that it's a kind of activity that is in all kinds of spheres of life, in work, in thinking about America in school, in activism, in all kinds of spaces, ritual happens. And the other distinctive thing to me about ritual is that ritual is repetitive, that it kind of continues to try to be somewhat similar to itself over time. And so I'm playing in my book and in the title, I'm playing with that sense of continuity, and also with that sense that ritual in America can happen outside of classically understood religious spaces.
Okay, I understand. So tell me a little bit about this, like the notion of awkwardness and how awkwardness can play into ritual, because this is where it gets really interesting for me, which is why I wanted to take it in reverse order.
Yeah. So going back to Catherine Bell, I mean, I think one of the other sort of general feelings about ritual in both religious studies, and I would actually just say in like the way people talk about ritual, is that ritual feels like home. It's the thing that is, it makes you feel like you are part of the culture you are in. So that implies some sort of synthesis between the activity you're doing and like your ideas, your beliefs, your feelings. And I noticed in my own life and then in my historical subjects' lives that in fact, often ritual does not feel like that. Mm-hmm. Well, it sometimes feels like this weird thing that maybe comes from the past, and like you wouldn't necessarily endorse it if somebody was like, what are the things you care most about? It wouldn't line up necessarily with all those things you say. And I'm arguing that sensation of like, I guess I'm doing this, but like, I wouldn't like, you know, get up and say this is something I love and believe in, is a sensation of awkwardness.
Mm. I understand. So, you know, when I was thinking, whenever I read stuff that takes place in a very specific historical context, your book is mostly taking place between 1790 and 1850. So I was like, what does this look like to me now? Whenever you were talking about the unnaturalness of all this, I pictured myself in an academic conference in those chairs, sitting for extraordinarily long periods of time, even though my body was screaming at me to do anything else. You know what I mean? So like, I was trying to like put myself into the position of some of the things that you were describing within the text to sort of connect with it a little more. And I'm wondering if that resonates with you and if you do the same kind of thing.
I sometimes wonder if the entire genesis of this book is actually my experience of academic conferences.
Okay, that's hilarious.
Because, you know, that feeling of when you go to your first academic conference as an academic baby and you suddenly realize there's all these rules, right? There's all these ways that they're not just procedure. They're like, oh, you start using this voice when you give your paper, and you do your ritual of deference to people when you're introducing them at the beginning of the panel, and the way you sit, and then the way that people leave halfway through, but like in a very specific way.
Yeah.
These are all conventions of the conference, and I play with that in my chapter on the American Bible Society, where I call it the conventions of a convention. Right? These are, and I don't think anybody in religious studies is like, yes, I love that about our conferences. Those right. are clearly good for us. Those are all yeah. the things we believe in.
Oh my gosh,
they're,
I love it.
Yeah, and so I'm playing with both the fact that like. I think they're a little out of step with what we purport to say we believe in. And also they physically feel weird and bad yeah. sometimes.
Yeah. And okay.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is like, we keep as a species, human beings, yes. we keep doing these things throughout history. We may lose some, they become outdated and they kind of fall away, but then we like seem to replace them with something that is seemingly just as unnatural and just as awkward. So like, even though I can't really connect with a lot of the rituals that you were talking about within the book, I feel as if there are so many things that we still do that could, like, you could have just switched the examples in the book and it would be the same thing, you know?
Cool. Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, let's get into some of the content here. Can you just give me like, tell me like an overview of how the book is laid out? Because the thing that I was so impressed with is how short your book is, but also that it's only 4 chapters. I was like, this is amazing. This is so bold. This is so awesome. I love this. So maybe just like say like what the layout of the text is for the listeners.
Cool. Yeah. I really want to hype the book's shortness because I'm honestly insecure about it. Because I think so often we're like, look how long of a book I wrote.
No, I'm with you. 126 pages. This is for me. This is my jam right here. I'm all over it.
I think this is the, you know, probably one of the few dissertation to book books where I took out chapters instead of added them. So the structure of the book is that I do try to kind of, I mean, I want to talk about this, but like I try to make this a theory book. Like I want to introduce theoretical concepts that hopefully apply outside of American religion. And then I track that within the American context after the American Revolution, first with Freemasons, then with the American Bible Society, which if anybody's ever been to an academic conference, that chapter is for you. That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. And then a chapter on benevolence, which is about charity. And I'm kind of playing with these ideas of the weird way in which when we try to help people, we actually kind of pretend to be them.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, I talk about the domestic sphere and Catherine Beecher and this kind of idea of the domestic queen and how the home becomes another place where Americans work out what it means to be governed.
Okay.
So the structure. Yeah.
Wonderful. So let's get into this a little bit. So you have this very specific time period, 1790 to 1850. You open the book with George Washington and the ritual initiations of the Freemasons. And I'm wondering what it is about this particular time period that, you know, sucked in your attention and made you to like lead off, like, you know, focus the whole entire book around this very specific 60-year period.
Well, so the kind of argument of the book is like the historical argument. And I know, Greg, that you're a historian, so hopefully this resonates.
Dodgy.
is that we said we had an American Revolution, then why the heck do we have all these rituals that are about hierarchy?
Mm.
So it's about the completeness of the American Revolution. So that's why it's set right after the American Revolution.
Wonderful.
And Freemasons in particular are, I think, a really useful place to think about this because they were powerful dudes who loved dressing up like kings and knights and priests.
So yeah, which is ironic because they fought against monarchy and those literally. Types of things, right?
Right. And Freemasons like were very involved in the American Revolution. And so, yeah, these are revolutionary dudes who are cosplaying kingliness, essentially.
That is so well stated. I absolutely love the way you just said that. That's amazing.
They also, I think, are really crucial for the history of, like, there's this super boring category that University of Chicago wouldn't let me put in the title, which is civil society, which is actually really important for my argument. And civil society is this really capacious category of American life that's like almost, it's like everything. It's like colleges, churches, nonprofits, advocacy organizations. It's all these things that are where we like do society that mm-hmm. are not the government and are not like commerce, essentially.
Sure. And there's power within those as well.
And that's a big part of my book, is thinking about how that's a big sphere in which we get bossed around in American life. And it's a sphere in which we both feel a lot of freedom because we're in charge of it. And it's also a place that we let people tell us what to do. So Freemasons are crucial to that history because they're like sort of the OG civil society. They make up the notion that we're going to start a club for ourselves. And it's sort of theoretically open to everyone, except that we're going to have these super weird initiations where only some people get in, right? So like it's contemporary analogy. The current version of it is frats and sororities.
Yeah.
Right. This very weird thing that we have on college campuses where people cosplay hierarchy and say that they're creating community, making this thing open to everybody. So all that to say, Freemasons, I think, get at some really core ideas about what it means to belong in American society.
You know, something that's really fascinating about this is like whenever there is a group of powerful people, sure, they have power, but that power has to feel powerful. And it also has to be sort of like viewed by the wider society as actually being power. Like you can see examples throughout history of a person, like maybe like a despot or a tyrant or something who was like overthrown, where people used to see this person as an authority figure, but then stopped collectively seeing it that way and then led to the downfall. So in order to have that power, there has to be like the feeling, and you talk about the sensation of governance and how powerful people act in order to make their power feel real. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit more about the idea of how governance happens behind closed doors, dating back to the founding of the country, to make the people outside the rituals like believe in that power and, you know, feel that that power is real, even though it's occurring out of sight. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Cool. Yeah. So there's this kind of foundational theory of governing rituals that is called sovereign ritual, which I never know if it's Geertz or Gertz. But Clifford Geertz, this is his kind of important contribution to this field. And his idea is that a king in part rules you by putting on a show, that like dazzling you with their spectacle is part of how power becomes real, which I think is true. But I think in America, it's a little bit different, where we also have all these rituals, like, for example, when Freemasons are in their lodge and the doors are closed, or when the college president and the board of trustees has their meeting, where the business of governance gets done. And in the United States, we justify that by saying that either anyone could have joined if they wanted to, theoretically, anybody could have been on the board of trustees, or we create like a proof that something happened there, right? Like, so I talk about minutes and the how minutes are a form of ritual. But I think that what's really crucial to me is that all of these types of rituals behind closed doors do some level of hand waving, where they say, nothing to see here, don't worry, like it's probably going on in some kind of equal way. There's probably some amount of shared governance, don't worry about it. And that is a really important part of what it feels like to be an American, is to kind of assume that there's some democratic form of governance going on that you don't have to pay attention to.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering what this, you mentioned cosplay and things like that earlier, and I want to know a little bit more about this because you have so much cool stuff in the book, like photos of artifacts that were extremely fascinating, but I was looking at and I was like, yeah, I don't really understand this. This is kind of something that I'm still wrapping my brain around. And you talk about like these like Mason aprons that are like artistically decorated. And then there's like something that you talk about, like drawn stages. Yeah. And I am so interested in the spectacle behind all of this. Like what is like the dress and decor like, and like, why does that make them feel powerful? And like, what is the meaning behind all these things?
Cool. Yeah. So this connects to your behind closed doors question, because even though people are behind closed doors when they're governing in American civil society, they feel a need to put on a show and for themselves, right? And this is what Freemasons do. They have these aprons that are really beautiful objects that are made out of silk, and they're embroidered with all of this Masonic legends and stories and symbols. And part of what I argue is that the regalia of Freemasonry is really important, because when you put it on, you can do all kinds of things. You can pretend to be a king in a ritual. But crucially, you always have the option of taking it off. Mm-hmm. So to me, the analogy here is like, you know, the kind of skull and bones idea of power, where like, you know, boys can go do wild things in that secret ritual at Yale.
Yeah.
And the point is not that something transformative happens there. The point is that they can do wild things, and then they can pretend that it never happened.
Mm, yes.
So it's that ability to put on essentially a costume and then take it off that makes these rituals powerful. And I think actually what's really important to me about that is that the feeling that gives those people is like embarrassment, right? Mm. If you feel like you have to take off your stupid, or not stupid, but your, you know, sort of embarrassing outfit in order to go then do the rest of your life, I think that shows that you don't think this is all sort of cohesive, that there's actually some sort of rupture between what you're doing inside and how you're trying to behave outside. And to give you another example from our world, I think of this all the time with academic regalia.
Oh yeah.
Which I love, right? Like academic regalia, why did I get a PhD? Probably to go buy that robe. At the same time, would I teach in that robe? No, I would feel so silly, right? And I think that's because the kind of pomp and hierarchy that it invokes in me is something that I cannot inhabit all the time within this context of purported equality.
Interesting. Well, and you also talk about in the book how like a lot of this regalia, these aprons and things like that, the Masons would wear, they would wear out in public. And yes. So they would like go around in the world like this. And that just seems really fascinating, because it's kind of like, is like sort of like these secrecy. There's the secrecy behind these rituals, but then they're also out in public wearing it around. And I'm wondering if you can just elaborate on that a little bit for me, because I'm just like, why are they doing this if it's supposed to be some kind of like ritual behind closed doors, et cetera?
Totally. That's a really important point, because they don't wear their aprons all the time, right? So for example, DeWitt Clinton is like the head of the Freemasons in New York. He's also at one point the mayor of New York City. He's also at another point the governor of the state of New York. So he's a powerful dude. He doesn't wear his Masonic apron all the time, but when Masons go on a procession outside, they all wear their aprons. Mm-hmm. And I think this gets to this really important point that these societies are not truly secret, right? If nobody knew that it existed at all, it yeah. wouldn't be doing what it needs to be doing. So it has to be just public enough that people are aware that, don't worry, the serious men are doing their serious business. They got it handled.
Speaking of the serious business, you talk a little bit about like the choreography and like bodily contortions of some of these like things. And this was highly amusing to me. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about like, what was actually happening in some of these like meetings where these rituals were taking place? Like, what are these like choreographic bodily contortions that are happening, and like, what do they look like?
Yeah. Ugh, Masonic ritual is so cool. I mean, there's acting out of a story. So like you play this role and I play that role. Then there's, and I want to be clear, like this, a lot of this comes from exposés of Freemasons, but, almost all historians of Masons kind of use the exposés, in part because we have nothing else, and also because there's some evidence to show that Masons themselves had to look at the exposés to remember how to do the choreography during the ritual, because it's so ornate.
Oh, yeah.
They would tie up an initiate, either in a cloth or in a rope. And definitely there is evidence that they beat each other up. Mm. And I talk about how that violence of the initiation, you know, which of course is so similar to hazing.
Yeah.
It's very important to them that nobody gets that hurt. So that it, just like the apron, it's something you can kind of pretend to do. Do it very seriously, but you don't get anybody too hurt. And so you haven't crossed this threshold into like being, you know, uncontrolled or being like those uncivilized people, which shows why you get to be a powerful dude, because you have the ability to pretend and then stop.
I see. And then like the person who had that happen to them, they can continue to feel that like pain or whatever later on. So it's like a reminder of what happened to them. So it's like almost like they carry this like new feeling with them after they've left that room. So it's like it actually really happened, you know. Does that make sense?
Sure. But also I think there's, and I actually do think that probably people got hurt and that, you know, getting beat up is traumatic, right? So I bet people took things away from that. But I definitely think the ritual is intended to give the initiate sort of a whisper of violence, right? That you can have this happen to the surface of your body and then stop, as opposed to like putting a wound in your body.
Gotcha. Okay. So, you know, whenever we have like rituals and things like that, what I'm wondering about is, you know, I'm always thinking about like how society is changing, like as like a, you know, 38-year-old parent, I'm thinking about what life will be like around in this country when my daughter is in like my age or a little older. So I'm always wondering how change happens, and change tends to be super slow. And I'm wondering if ritual that we inherit from generation to generation prevents any like changes that you were noticing, if there was any examples that you see, like where these kinds of like attachments to ritual prevent change from happening, and like keep us stunted as a society. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I mean, because part of what I'm arguing is that ritual is sort of conservative, that like, so one of the metaphors I use is that it's like the unfashionable furniture that you bring with you into your new home, right? Like your grandmother gives you this furniture and you have to like bring it with you and it looks sort of weird in your new house.
Sure.
And I don't think that prevents change. Like, I think in fact, I would argue that there's lots of change happening all the time, despite that, right? And it's just that the ritual creates an experience of dissonance as things are changing. This is why I don't call it ritual failure. I call it ritual awkwardness, because it's not enough dissonance to like prevent anything, or to, it just kind of makes things feel weird. So like another contemporary example I have of this kind of awkwardness is, you know, that weird way in which politicians, when they're on the campaign, go and do like the eating of sandwiches in small
town. Sure. Absolutely.
And it's like so weird, right? And they're like pretending to be normal Joe Schmo.
Yeah.
With your meat sandwich.
Every time I see it, I'm like, well, this is the most fraudulent ruse imaginable. Like, because you never believe it. Cause like they'll be like eating a hot dog, then they'll make like some insane face, like, wow, that's the most amazing thing I've ever had. And so it's just like so. It's just play and acting, and exactly. you can see it every single time, but yet they continue to do it every 2 years whenever there's a camera pointed. So I understand for sure.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I'm getting at, is that I don't think they even think that they're coming off as plausible.
Yeah.
And yet their sense of confidence that they are powerful enough to like do this weird, awkward thing and then move on from it, it just makes it keep happening and happening and happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm not arguing that ritual stunts us. I just think it becomes a way for us to see this weird way in which some people can kind of pull off these weird plays. I mean, I am getting at the way in which ritual is a moment of as if, And this is a big argument within ritual studies. I mean, I think a lot of ritual studies has argued that ritual is not like theater. And I want to call attention to the way in which sometimes ritual really is about putting on something temporary that does not transform you entirely, and then you get to walk away from it.
Okay, cool. So I got a couple more questions on Masons because I just I can't stop. I'm wondering about, you know, pop culture depictions of Masons. Like, if you have any like favorite depictions or least favorite depictions, because we hear about these groups of people like growing up in the US, like we learn about them in various ways, and then they're depicted in certain ways within the media that we consume. And I'm wondering if you, who have a much deeper fascination with this group, I'm wondering if you have any personal favorites or least favorites that have maybe been helpful or detrimental in our understanding of this group as, you know, a historical group that matters to the country in general.
Yeah, it's cool because I was just teaching Freemasons to my students, and like there is this inherent interest in Freemasons, which I think comes from a national treasure and like that kind of understanding. And also the fact that a lot of people have parents or grandparents that were Freemasons. So like the first thing I always try to clarify is if your grandfather was a Freemason and he's some working class dude, I'm not impugning his honor, right? Like there's this major transition that happens in the history of Freemasons where right after the revolution, they're powerful dudes. And then they have this big fall from grace. And then in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it becomes this really important association for working class, in particular, like, ethnic American groups really participate heavily. But what's, I think, important about the national treasure and the kind of secret cabal sense of conspiracy is that actually, like, I encourage that. I think there are secret cabals in American life, right? Like, there actually are places where people are leading us behind closed doors without much transparency at all. I just think it's, like, the most banal book. The cabal is happening and yet also is not as exciting as we want it to be.
I understand. Well, and you know, something else I'm super curious about is like your experiences as a researcher, because you include all these amazing artifacts, and I'm wondering about any like travel or places you went to. Like you talk about the Scottish Rite Masonic Museum a whole bunch, and I'm wondering if you just have any like places or things that you did that were like really amazing as like, you know, when you're just going through the research process in general, and anything that stands out to you from those times.
Well, so first of all, sorry, I just want to add one thing to the pop culture thing.
Oh, sure. Sorry.
No. My favorite pop culture depiction of Freemasonry is in a TV show called Queen Sugar, which is on the OWN network, the Oprah network. And it's
okay.
Totally beautiful. It's about this like this Black family that's kind of dealing with the legacy of agriculture outside of New Orleans. And it has this incredible scene of Prince Hall Freemasonry during a funeral. And I think a lot of white Americans are not familiar with Black Freemasonry, which is called Prince Hall Freemasonry. And it starts at the same time as white Freemasonry, or it happens right after the revolution. So,
okay.
So it's unbelievably early. And one of the things I'm trying to show in the book is that there's all kinds of forms of fraternity and civil society that are not about white people governing the rest of society. And if anybody has any interest in Freemasonry, I highly encourage you to learn more about Prince Hall Freemasonry, because it's like all of the spectacular ritual, but channeled into totally radical, interesting forms of power.
Very
but
cool.
To your question of archives and looking at Freemasonry, I mean, it's just the most wonderful, bonkers material culture. And if anybody's ever in New York City, my suggestion is the Chancellor Robert Livingston Masonic Library of the Grand Lodge. Crazy title. It's essentially the Grand Lodge of New York City. And the reason it's such a wonderful place to visit is that you actually get to see inside a lodge, which is an incredible piece of architecture. And the secret is anybody can go inside now. They've opened up both the archives and the museum, which did not previously used to be true of Masons. But you have to make an appointment. And it's just because they're really short-staffed. But they're so, in fact, they're sort of, they're always excited to have people who aren't Masons, because that's usually the only people who want to come see it. But, you know, they have the aprons, which are absolutely wonderful. And almost all Masonic material culture is just luscious. So highly recommend that.
Very cool. Yeah. You know, something else that jumps out at me from the book is the way that corporations come into the discussion. And I'm wondering how the corporate matters within the context of this book, and then if there's any connections with the corporate to today as well. I'm just like, I thought that was really fascinating piece of detail within the text.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. So I've been talking about civil society, which includes clubs and colleges and nonprofits. And I think that there's a big misconception, which is that corporations are only about commerce. We think when we hear the word corporation, we think commerce. Corporations are all the nonprofits too. And it's been a crucial move within religious studies to recognize how absolutely important this category is for what religion looks like in both the early modern period and in contemporary, not just the United States. I mean, Julian, I know you know him. He joined us in Japan. So part of what a corporation is an intermediary between a sovereign, like a king, and the normal people. It's like this weird form where there's this group of people who essentially get to tell society what to do, but they're not the government. And that's something I really try to call attention to, because so, you know, we think of like corporate culture for like a corporation like Walmart, and corporate culture is a whole bunch of rituals, right? It's like how the greeter at the door at Walmart is supposed to address people. Corporations that are not selling you stuff, like, you know, the Red Cross or any kind of nonprofit, including a university, also have a culture of how they run that relies on rituals. And so that is absolutely part of the genesis of this book, is to try to create ways to talk about corporate culture and its ritual forms in spaces that I think people are not used to seeing it, like the awesome. AAR.
I love it. Well, you know, you mentioned Catherine Bell earlier, and like whenever I talk to people who have, you know, specific areas of interest, I'm always curious what scholars inspire them. And so I'm wondering if you have any ritual theorists, authors, you know, intellectuals, people that you like kind of look up to as sort of like a thought leader in the fields that you work in, that you wanted to shout out, or any texts that you wanted to recommend to listeners out there, anything at all that springs to mind off the top of your head?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one that's like absolutely at the core of this book, and he blurbs the back of the book too, is Joseph Roach, he's actually not a religious studies guy. He's a performance studies guy. But the reason I'm obsessed with him, and have always been obsessed with him, is that he's very interested in this question of change over time. So like, how does a performance that happened 200 years make its way into the present? And he very provocatively shows this through the idea of like a ritual. It's like a form of ghosting, that like a person 50 years later, all like, you know, for, here's a really classic Joseph Roach example, Justin Bieber doing a little kind of Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
He's like literally got the ghost of Elvis Presley in him.
Mm.
And I have a different way of talking about ritual, but Joseph Roach definitely, I think he made me feel excited about talking about ritual historically. And I think that there is, I mean, I'm just going to, this is like sort of my personality, is that I like to throw provocations then invite people to come at me so we can have more of a discussion.
Sure.
A lot of ritual studies that comes out of Catherine Bell and then sort of comes through Ronald Grimes as sort of an inheritor of her work in some ways, is very interested in like a anthropological present, where you're just seeing something in a frozen moment, as opposed to kind of understanding ritual as part of historical change or not change, but in any sense, kind of like a wider frame. So I think Joseph Roach's work really invites us to think about ritual over like a 300 year period or 500 year period or that kind of thing.
Wonderful. You know, just in general about this book, I read your acknowledgement section. I tend to do that. And in the acknowledgement section, you write about learning about your own writing tics, which I thought was really fascinating because like, I'm always wondering about like the process behind the scenes of getting us these like shiny, like well manicured products that we get, like whenever we see a finished book, but there's so much that goes into that. And I'm wondering like about your own process and what you learned about yourself in putting together this book.
Yeah. So like, first of all, for any graduate students who are on this journey, no editor is going to come swoop in at the end and do this for you. It's your friends. Only your friends. Well, this is just like, it's such hard labor that they're the only ones willing to do it. You know, for example, like I put, I'm so bad at grammar that I don't even know how to say it. But like, if you have two clauses, I'll put the last clause before the first clause, like a bazillion times in the same paragraph. but also I have all kinds of, I think it once again comes from, I grew up in like, I went to like Waldorf schools, which are these theosophist schools. And so I'm like very poorly educated in basic kind of English grammar stuff. So I love things like overuse of italics and overuse of exclamation marks. And one of the things that I've come to embrace about myself is that's just how I sound. Mm-hmm. And I want my writing to reflect the way I feel in person. And I sort of wish other people did that more too.
Any reflections on being a part of the fabulous Class 200 series from University of Chicago Press?
Yes. I mean, in relationship to my overuse of exclamation points and italicization, I think they are absolutely at the forefront of helping people develop style and write in a way that feels both kind of distinctive to you as a scholar and slightly new. But the thing that I love about Class 200 the most is that I think that they're developing a list of books that a religious studies department could read together. Because religious studies is so weird, right? You have this person who does ancient Christianity and contemporary Buddhism, and like theoretically, you actually don't have that much overlap in your interests. And so what are the core ideas of religious studies that bring us together in a conversation? And I think Class 200 is thinking about what those are. They're the secular. They're things like, you know, ritual. Like ritual is like an incredibly old-fashioned religious studies topic that in fact we all have to confront. And so I think that they're really generating a list of books that will allow us to talk between our subfields and thus become better friends and better scholars.
You know, I'm looking at the front cover right now, and I would hate myself if I didn't ask you about this, but I'm wondering if you can tell me about the cover and the design here, because there's some interesting detail here, and I'm looking at the back cover talking about the cover illustration, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the front cover, because it's so cool.
So the image is of this like weird stick figure, and it's actually, it's an anti-Masonic image. It's a image that was making fun of Masons. And what it's saying is like, Masons are these, they're doing these weird actions that are very wooden. Mm-hmm. And that gets like to the heart of what I mean by awkward, right? Awkward is when you are doing something and you're kind of being, you're being a tryhard, right? Like, so like when you try to be fancy and you pick up a teacup and your little finger comes out.
Right.
What's important about that is that you are both trying to do something in a kind of stylized way, and it's supposed to look like you're trying. This is like the central argument about the origins of civility, that it's about not just doing the right bow and holding the right fork, but demonstrating kind of that you are putting on a show for others. And so that's part of what I mean by awkward, is that there's always kind of this sense of, ugh, like, are people watching me? And also I'm having to put my body in these weird positions. Yeah. And then on top of that, I have the book designer very smartly put the text in such a way that you have to crane your head. And
it's so cool. That makes it awkward.
Exactly.
It's wonderful. Oh, that is so thoughtful. You know, and I think that really ties this back to the beginning. That's kind of like a nice circular ending for the conversation where, you know, we can think about the ways that people put on a show for each other to this day. This is such a human thing to do. It exists across history, across centuries. We can observe it across, you know, so many periods of time, many different places around the world. And it's just like this tendency that ties us all together as a species. It kind of almost doesn't even really matter what continent you're on. Mm-hmm. There's like a form of this that I feel could be like looked at almost anywhere, you know?
And I like my greatest hope and dream for this book is that I get to talk to somebody about what awkwardness feels like in 500, you know, BC somewhere. And I hope that that's a sensation that we can kind of talk about together.
I love it. Well, Dr. Dana Logan, I have absolutely loved this conversation about awkward rituals, sensations of governance in Protestant America. I'm wondering if you can direct the listeners to any links or ways to connect with you that you would like to put out there.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. I'm Pop Apologist. Can tell that comes from my pre-academic days.
I love it.
Pop apologist.
I love it. Well, Dana Logan, thank you so much for joining me. I have had a real blast.
Thank you, Greg. This was awesome.